Hi and welcome. I'm Daniel Rickaman, your mayor and guide to everything that's happening around town. Deep dive with us into the heart of the best kept secret in the Southeast, Columbia, South Carolina. From the buzzing culinary scene to the business trailblazers pushing our city's boundaries, we're here to give you an insider's glimpse into the vibrant tapestry of people, places, and opportunities that make Columbia unparalleled. Thanks for tuning in, and without further ado, let's jump right into the show. Good afternoon, everybody. Another exciting episode of Around Town. So glad that you're tuning in today. We have a special guest today, Mr. Stephen Chesley, our artist. Do we call you an artist in residence because you've lived here so long?
Yeah, sort of like Gauguin and Tahiti. You pair those two together.
Stephen has been heavily involved with us, working closely on the Urban Canvas program, but also Stormwater Studios, but been a real staple in our arts community since he moved here in 1979.
About that time, graduated from the School of Architecture at Clemson, specializing in city planning, and came here and was a state water resource planner for about a year, working on scenic rivers and so on. Didn't know that, did you?
I didn't. I love it. I learned something again today. Well, tell us the rest of the story.
Well, let me see. I graduated in 1980, came here with the Water Resources Commission. It was headed by Claire Guess. And the Water Resources was water volume. DHEC was water quality. So we dealt with that. And part of that, what we added in, aside from well certification and permitting with BC Spigner, we got into the scenic rivers, which is try and preserve the collar lands of our rivers, especially scenic ones. And we sort of designated those like the Edisto, the PD, Little PD, beautiful rivers. And then after about a year, I left. We had a reduction in force. The budget wasn't there. So I had always been interested in art, but the practicum was, I mean, your parents mean well to enculturate you to equate income with happiness. That's what society is. So you're not going to be an artist, you know, or a shoemaker, because you're going to not have money. You're going to be unhappy. Well,
I used to say that about shoemakers until I just picked up my shoes. Right. With your
Italian
soles.
Wingtips. Yeah. And I was very fortunate to graduate each time, both high school, undergraduate, and graduate, to graduate in a recession. So that was always motivating for me to and directional to head me towards an art thing. And I had learned a craft. I had learned to survive by learning auto mechanics and carpentry. Two things, if you're male, you can do anywhere in the world, as a counselor said that to me and saved my life. So I built houses for 5 years and kept trying to get a planning position. And I was overqualified for entry level and underqualified for regular planning positions. So then I ended up in my cousin is Daniel Vismore, who had Vismore, McGill, and Bell, which is a planning firm. So I remember visiting one time in Oak City, North Carolina, and he was getting out of the car. And I said, "Danny, where were you?" He says, "I was in Italy." I said, "Well, what were you doing in Italy?" He said, "I was looking at buildings." And I said, "I want to do so." So it was my way of combining art and science, the art of the architecture and city planning, and science, which I like too. And I thought about being a marine biologist, but of course, organic chemistry port ended that real quick. So we moved forward to 1980, then after Water Resources, and then I decided that I was already used to no income and that sort, and I didn't need anything. I was never engage the money so much as a motivation, which is, and I look at it as a coping skill that I needed. So my plan was, and I said, "Well, I'm going to paint. I enjoy that. I'm happy with it. Why are you going to paint?" Because South Carolina, and I stayed here in South Carolina and Columbia, because it was, of all things, it was the climate was designated subtropic. And one of my favorite painters when I started, the spiritualist, was Paul Gauguin, who went to Tahiti, which is the tropics. So I said, Well, this is tropics too. And you can get eaten by an alligator in the low country. And then we had Geechee and Gullah culture, which is, you know, really rich to me in spirituality and those sorts of things. So I started painting. And then I said, well, how are you going to survive? And I said, well, with the carpentry. I'll do the carpentry. And the MO was to move towards someday being a contractor. And then the money from the carpentry was to keep the art studio free. It was to subsidize that so I could paint free. That was the whole thing. I wasn't concerned with market. At that time, we didn't have much of a gallery. We had George Walker was the gallery system here, was one. And Betsy Havens had one.
Yep.
And Carol Saunders came in. And then
Carol came, what, the mid-80s?
Something like that. I remember going to Motor Supply when it was Motor Supply.
Wow.
Yeah. We can talk about that too. So I started the painting. I said, and I talked to Boyd Saunders, who was sort of a mentor toward me when I learned printmaking. So I took full advantage of USC printmaking under tutelage of Boyd Saunders because of the expense of presses and things. There's no way you're going to learn that. So I learned that in conversations with him. I remember distinctly talking with him one day. I said, well, how do you do this? How do you present yourself? And he said, well, there's sort of two ways you can do it. You can get an umbrella and do the art shows, or wait until you have something to say and then debut that way. So I took the second way. So I wanted to just sort of break with society from time and appointments and get on the river, get into the wild. So I went for the first 5 years, I dedicated myself to the Sea Islands and our river and rivers around here, especially the Saluda. So I would go there almost daily in plein air in the Saluda. There's nobody there. That's where I saw the mink. So on a rock one day, taking a break, and this little mink comes around my feet. And he circles the rock. He's about a foot and a half long. Doesn't notice me because I'm not moving on the rock. He circles the rock, goes to the next rock, circles it, and then I move. He sees me and dives. That was my mink story. So it was amazing. And I used to sit, not what is now Boyd Island. I called it the Fan. And there's a way you can wade out to these three islands that sort of fan out. You can see them in aerial photos. And there's nothing there. There's a beautiful pavement outcrop. It's completely wild. And I would spend the days out there isolated in painting. And it was sort of a wonderment to me to, because I could see the rush hour on the bridge, and I never saw anybody at the river. So I thought, you have no idea what's here. This is a real gift. This is really beautiful, and we have it here in Columbia.
That was the biggest. That's always been something that's bothered me, is that when you come in on I-26, 126, you don't know that the river's there until you cross the bridge.
Right.
You know, now that we're with what's going on with the Carolina Crossroads, it's going to open it up. People are going to really see what a beautiful river we have. I think it's going to drive more people to really enjoy the river and take advantage of the greenway and all the work that we're doing.
I think so. When densities increase and we get to our walkability, keep working on that, especially when we probably get the river walk and connect that and get a connector, somehow maybe a pedestrian bridge across Hugie, the major arterials that are super dense, that you could walk completely all day through the city, all the way to the zoo and all the way.
You'll be able to go all the way to the dam.
Yeah. All the way to the California. Maybe tie it into a trail. So we have a lot of opportunity for
I'll let you make that trek first. And
I will. I'll do it. And I'll report to you how that works out.
That's a long one. Just get to the dam. But you know, the great part about it is all of it's becoming a reality. The bridges that we get in, we just put in for a $10 million bridge to connect over the rail, so we can go from Elmwood Park, so you wouldn't have to crawl over UG Street and be able to go in there. From there, you'd be able to go all the way to Bull Street without ever getting in your car.
That'd be great. I always envision. I remember Temple with his bridge project.
And you know what? And the other night at the bridge dinner, I bet I had five people go, you remember that guy had that idea? And I was like, just think if it would have happened, how cool it would have been.
I always think about, and we should have an architectural competition on the design of the bridge. I remember studying Pablo Soleri, and there was this international design competition for a footbridge. And then everybody came in with all this stuff, and he just got a piece of paper and folded it into a tunnel and laid it down. He got it. Something like that would be, you know, we get back to the architectural excellence and maybe as part of a component of Columbia as a cultural destination. I think we talked earlier about the in-migration. I think we're third or fourth in migration.
Yep.
Because Texas and Florida are first.
Yep.
So in that stat, it's like 80%, if I remember, is going to the coast. So I'm almost looking at Columbia as a place to reconstitute your stature, to get away from the urban density that is building unbelievably along the coast and the expense. I just read where in Charleston housing is 38% higher than Charlotte.
So I believe it.
The cost of living there is something. So we could actually prepare for that, which leads to extraterritorial influences on our city, not only countywide, but also statewide. Mm-hmm. What happens when these densities are so thick and exponential that people want to relocate? Are we going to pick that up? Or are they going to start coming to Columbia? So that's something interesting to think about, which I really hadn't thought about before.
Well, and so. I think people that are looking at Columbia, you know, we were named the best city in South Carolina to move to. And part of that had to do with, I think it's because we just have such a quality of life of living and all that we have going on in this community right now, which is, you know, we have a great arts community. Cool. We got a great cultural, everything from, you know, the Philharmonic to Nickelodeon to, you know, the concerts that happen here, the athletics that happen here, you know, our environment where we live, our culinary arts, our visual arts, you know, it's incredible. Tell us a little bit about you got in at carpentry, you're into the artist. Talk about how that all came in and what the arts community looked like as it kind of evolved. Because, I mean, we had cultural council, you know, you had Dot Ryle pushing all kinds of new things going
arts
on.
Arts commission was in full on.
Yep.
Yeah. Back then, it's like a little history. There was nothing here, I think, when I got here. I remember turning on Main Street one night. We were coming in for a grant, going to talk to a senator or something. And we turned at the north end, and those streetlights were there. So here I am with the urban design and everything. And here's the Capitol, the center of the city, the capital of South Carolina. And these streetlights are right in the middle of the view to the Capitol. And I thought, and the bragging about the lights, the guy that sold them, and he must have been very good, he said, you could read a newspaper at midnight. And I thought, oh man, I shook my head. And then went back to school and everything. And then I came back and they were gone. So I thought, there's hope. This is, something's happening here, you know? So after the water resources, you know, I did carpentry and painted all the time. We still had a very diverse balance of economics. We had an operational Vernon Mills produced duct. We had Klein Steel. We had another steel mill on Lady Street. We had Hinson Feed and Seed, where City Yard is now, that actually sold farming products and seeds. And then later it was Shearing's Oriental Rug.
I forgot about Shearing's.
We had M. Craig.
Yep.
Michael Craig producing furniture.
World renowned.
World renowned. In about 1979 is when Clark Elson came in. Now, I heard about the Vista, what we call the Vista now. You didn't go there. Right.
It's all chemical plant. I mean, chemical operations and industrial supply houses.
Well, I got the feeling that, you know, you wouldn't come out alive. So you didn't want to go there. You know, I never saw any of that really. But Clark got there and then partnered with Jim Lewis. The rent was economical and they started Lewis and Clark, internationally known furniture, avant-garde furniture designer. And Clark is still with us. Jim moved to California. We lost him. And then slowly, my first show was with Lewis and Clark. Went up the stairs. There's a little hallway.
Did Pocahontas right show up?
Yeah, did. Okay. Lewis and Clark. Well, it's sort of unnerving because I actually bought canvas from Vernon Mills.
Wow.
So I'm part of a history that goes way back that stopped. So that gives me pause. That's really, really something. And bought steel from Klein. Also, we had a woodworking place right next to what was the Confederate printing press.
Okay.
We had a woodworking. So we
I
had
didn't
a,
know that.
We had a lot of.
I knew Klein and the others, but I didn't know about the woodworking. I
have some pictures of it. I'll show you.
Yeah, I'd love to see that.
I used to go out and sketch at night. And I would go sort of a Hopper thing, Edward Hopper. He did these nightscapes. And I was really interested in that. So I'd go down past midnight on Gervais Street and on Main Street. And you didn't go to Main Street either. You know, the thoughts were, you know, you just didn't go there. It was violent or something, which I never saw. And I would go, but I did prepare. I remember where Boyd Plaza is now, there was a building. And I remember backing up to it because I wanted to sketch Sylvain's, the clock. There were no trees. It was just these buildings. And they had just put up the construction wall for the Marriott. That's how far this was. And I remember it was cold. And I don't know. I used to sharpen the ends of my paintbrushes just in case, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but I painted there and the police would stop and, you know, say, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm just painting. And they got to know me down there. So you were able to do that. Then slowly, and then Mayor Finley came in, and it sort of brought with him a little version of City Beautiful, which was started by Frederick Law Olmsted, I guess the very beginnings of about 1850s, and, mm-hmm. and what happened with Central Park. He's noted for that. And that went to that City Beautiful, and Olmsted and Burnham both got into it. The thought was that if you have, you know, civic consciousness and physical things, mostly 2D planning, which is sort of flat streetways and stuff from which was inherited from L'Enfant and Haussmann, like designs of Paris and London, those sorts of ideas, and they transferred over here to DC, had that. And the idea was that you would have a civic unity, and a civic consciousness that you took pride in because everybody could identify with a park and with fountains and so on and so forth. And it went almost to about 1920 when they realized that you can't have just a beautiful city without addressing the social problems like income and housing, especially, is a problem. So, which is it is today. So, and then a sort of a 3D planning developed, which took into consideration housing and buildings and how they impact the community. So sort of a modern planning started with that idea that you not only plan the flat layout, but you also are concerned with the architecture and elevations of your city and how they impact people. So, I had that first show, and slowly Clark would have these art shows. So that's why you came down. There's no other reason to go into the Vista. And slowly that evolved and it became more and more. And then Motor Supply became a restaurant. And we had the railway, the train station was full on. It had such a rich heritage. I mean, World War II, Korean War, they would all get out there. And we had the diner, the Seaboard Diner
Seaboard Diner, the home of the Psycho Burger.
It was iconic, you know. One of the things we could do is
resurrect that. It's the only place in town you got a cheeseburger that had mustard relish on it.
Oh, boy.
Psycho Burger.
I remember in my midnight forays, I'd go there.
Oh,
I'd
go there at 3 in the morning.
Oh, man. Yeah. Matter of fact, that would be a good project to resurrect that as an iconic place. Meet me at Seaboard.
So meet me at the Seaboard Diner.
Seaboard. And I've got the blueprints.
There in the Capitol Cafe were the only two places. Well, I take that back. There were three places. Because you had the Seaboard Diner, you had the Capitol Cafe, and you had Martin's Eats on Divine Street.
Oh, yeah.
Working all night.
Meet and Three. That was popular for a while. Yeah. And then, so we ended up with consultants. I think one, I believe his name was Lee. He came down and walked the river, and he said, just put marble dust down. Leave it alone. And that was his idea. And then the vista evolved because of the view down Gervais Street. So that whole terminology became. And then we got, as a compliment to that, Robert Marvin to do Sydney Park, Findlay Park. And he, I remember him teaching or coming in and lecturing at the planning department, Clemson. I remember listening to him, and also, God, who was it? Who was Hilton Head?
You talking about Frazier? Charles Frazier.
Charlie came up, and I'll never forget that. Both Robert Marvin and Charlie Frazier giving us lectures on, and that was the beginning of the organic and green developments. And I'll never forget Sunday morning, the television program. Charlie Frazier got national recognition because he did want to cut down a live oak for a parking lot. That's how much we've changed then. I mean, it was amazing. So Robert Marvin came in with his park idea, and it was his idea was a vertical playground. What he meant by that was the children and citizenry of Columbia mostly have their feet on synthetic ground, which is asphalt and cement. So what he wanted is these hills and pathways and fountains for the children to play on and challenge themselves, to get dirty, to roll around and have fun. That was the idea. And that little, I had an idea that that coffee house up there would have evolved into something that would be arts related and start dialogue, sort of like, I always had this vision of the Cedar Tavern in New York, where all the abstract expressionists would meet, Franz Klein, Jackson Pollock, de Kooning, and you started this thing about art and culture to and generate. I thought that for Goat Feathers for a while, but it never seemed to catch on. And so slowly the change in the vista started to happen. You know, the businesses started to look at it, and then the train station came up. They were changing the tracks, and then I think it was Bill Dukes got a hold of it, and we have the Blue Marlin. But for the Blue Marlin, we lost the Seaborn, which I still think we should resurrect that. It would be iconic. And one of the reasons I liked it too was Hopper's Nighthawks, the painting he did, where you're looking into this diner late at night, and there's the Seaborn Diner, and I used to stare at that thing and think about that, what was going on in there. So that sort of romanticism. So slowly it gentrified. Michael Craig, we lost him. And Vernon Mills shut down. And then slowly City Art changed. The Henson Feed Seed left. And we started to evolve. And the business is located there. And the rest is history as we see it now. So it all started, in my mind, with Clark Elson having art exhibitions there. And you mentioned early about all the talent we have. I am always overwhelmed. I don't care where I go. New York City, they can brag about it all they want. And D.C., Chicago, L.A. When I come back here, I see so much talent. It's unbelievable. Writers, dancers, actors, guitarists, musicians, symphony, painters, sculptures. It's all right here. It's amazing.
We just don't tell anybody.
I don't know why it is.
We don't tell anybody. And I think we're trying to change that and really shout to the mountaintops of what a great community are. And we do. I think we have a total package. You look all the way around. We've got quality of life for living. We got affordable housing options. We have access to beautiful natural resources, but we have all these other resources, like you mentioned. I mean, we've got these award-winning artists, award-winning published authors, musicians, you name it. We have it here in our town.
It's incredible. I mean, I just, I'm almost in disbelief all the time. So, and why this isn't like that. And I guess, you know, part of our makeup is we have transients. We have government, we have a students, transients, and military. So,
but that's even changing now. Seven right. out of 10 people who are retiring at Fort Jackson are staying in Columbia now.
Yes.
We got students now that, by engaging them and seeing the opportunities and the job shifting that we have here, are staying here. You know, we're seeing more people living downtown. So I think we're on the right track. But how do we tie that in with all this talent we have? How do we tie it into like the urban canvas project?
The urban canvas, you know, it all harks back to, you know, the internet, Blue Sky, internationally known, Clark, internationally known. It's like, what can we do to, along with our public art? This is a, it also, let me go backtrack a little bit, give the background of it. Michaela Brown, M. Brown, we had a approached by the German consulate in Atlanta, and they had some funds for something. And that fit right in with our sister city, Kaiserslautern, who we've already had exchanges on that. So we had a budget, we put together, and we couldn't come together because of COVID. So it had to be virtual. So we were thinking about what could we do? And we thought about, you know, wearing masks and flying over, but, you know, no. So we came up with the collage and we worked on it mostly through COVID. And then we exchanged ideas. We would move the images around and balance them and see. Then we came up with something. And then we had the title. And then it was, okay, we got this collage, virtual collage. Now, how do we make it bricks and mortar? How do we make it into something that people can look at? You know, we don't want to, you know, one of those fungal things, you know, not like that. So we thought about a lamination at a kiosk or something that would be public and would light and it would have a design to it. And then I was walking behind the library one time and I looked up and saw this piece of art that is printed on this huge format. It's, I believe it's 20 by 30 feet. And I've been watching that for quite a while and I didn't see any fading and I didn't see it ripping and doing all these things. And I saw it as impermanent too. So it could change. It wasn't painted on there. It wasn't welded on. So I thought, well, we're going to print something. We're going to print it like that. Okay. And I didn't know where it was going to go or anything. So I made that happen as fast as I could. Got it printed. They couldn't do it the size we had here. So we had to go to Atlanta to have it printed. And so we worked that out. And then Michaela and I rented a U-Haul and drove to Atlanta, which killed me. Because I don't know if you've driven in Atlanta lately, but it's a nightmare. And then I was having a tough time driving. You know, we got rush hour and everything, and then got in a heavy rainstorm. And I drove back, and I was completely exhausted, and I didn't know it, but I had COVID. So I drove back this canvas with COVID. And then stayed there a little bit. And then I was thinking about it while I was recovering. And I said, you know, there's a lot of murals. And they seem to be everywhere now. And it's, you know, people, you know, don't think about them much anymore. I mean, you look at them and then you're stuck with it. And then banner, you know, there's a lot of banners and this and that. And some are really well. And I thought, well, what is a different term that we could come up with to change the approach or how you engage this art? And I thought, well, it's a, we'll say canvas, like I'm a painter, it's a canvas. Well, and then it's public. So we're going to make it urban. Okay, urban canvas. Okay, what do you do with it? Well, I was thinking about Banksy and a lot of those things. They're the, like these guerrilla artists that do these really meaningful, wonderful things and then disappear. And then people hack it out of the wall and things like that. So I thought, well,
the way we could do this is that, first of all, wouldn't be the reproduction of the art on this urban canvas would not be restricted to canvas and paint, to painters. And I thought jewelry makers. Then I even expanded that. Well, we could put writers that could put text on there and just put it. And the idea is to move these around the city where you don't expect them. And I think we talked about the wall behind Todd and Moore.
Yeah.
You're sitting at that stoplight at Blossom and Hugie and Assembly. Hugie. And you're looking at, imagine a picture of something there. And then you see it a couple of days and it's gone. And then a different one's there. Then you're driving someplace else, you see another one. And it starts to be this thing, well, that's interesting. And then once you say, well, what is that? Why would I saw this thing here and it's gone now. And then with the expansion of the identification of this, the PR, the public relations, they say, well, that's the Urban Canvas Project, which, as we mentioned, it debuted here. Nobody else is doing this. Nobody else called this Urban Canvas. So, and you're not stuck with a permanent mural. And also it can address, you know, murals are for painters, more or less. This can be for jewelry makers.
It could be for anybody.
It could be dancers. It could be musicians. You could put a score on there. You could have them play the instrument. All of our artists, actors in full costume, just a picture, no narrative, to have the and unify people by what is this? What is that a picture of? There's no narrative. And then you could discuss it. You start this dialogue about art throughout the city, and they change and move around. So I thought that would be really interesting.
I love it.
And if the public starts to see this, it might be fun in a busy day with a full schedule. You're tired. You come to a stoplight, you know, and you see the light change and your car doesn't move. And you see the cars ahead of you with five car lengths for two cars during the light change. And finally, a half hour later, when you get up there, there's a urban canvas for you, and you can smile about it. You can say, well, that's nice. You know, it's almost worth waiting in line for half an hour to get through this light so that I can look at this piece of art.
What I love about it when you first were telling me about the whole project was the fact that everybody in the arts community can participate. It's not limited. And I think that's what's so exciting about it. And I think that's what's going to be interesting as this evolves and it continues to grow and it spreads out, that it's not just going to be paintings. It's not just going to be a jewelry maker. It's not just going to be an actor. I mean, it's blending all of these and sharing that and letting people find their passions and their happiness in that and seeing it and making them think and dream a little bit by what they see. And I love the idea of pulling up. I mean, I pulled up today on Assembly and Gervais Street, and I'm looking at the parking garage that we own there, and I'm like, man, you could put 30 by 10 there easy. If not 30 by 20, it'd be pretty cool looking, you know, and the people pull in and suddenly, you know, for a week there's some great, you know, collage of art, and then suddenly it's gone.
Right. Very interesting.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about Stormwater Studios. For a lot of people don't know about it. It's in a great little hub there along with some what I call pretty long-term famous artists.
Right. Well, it all started, of course, back in the mini City Beautiful movement. 808 evolved. It was subsidized artist spaces right next to the steel mill, which is now the Hyatt, I believe. Yeah. I remember buying steel there too. So it's like, gosh, I'm old enough to have bought duck from a cotton mill and steel from a steel mill on Lady Street. You know, it's like, wow. So slowly the land values, because of seeded by culture, which is nothing new. It's almost like Soho in New York. It starts and nobody wants to go there. The artists go there because of economics. They start a community. They have a dialogue. Then all of a sudden, you know, people start to look at it. And then they start to invest in it, and slowly the gentrification happens. And then it becomes too expensive and the artists have to leave. And not only artists, but if you have local businesses, bakeries, for instance, or small little restaurants, you know, meat and three, they leave because the rent and the expense becomes too much for them. So that progression changes. So we had with the Columbia Development Corporation, Fred Delk had that, and we had he had acquired in the Columbia Development Corporation, CDC, that parcel of land. And so as we saw that we were going to be relocated, the idea came that we could transpose or populate or come up with something and build it there. Then we wanted to, because we're artists and it's bad art, to get architects. Our local architects, by the way, are super talented, you know. So we have that artistry too, which is unbelievable. We need to tap into that more. So we got that and designed the building, put it there, and it's next to Kinsler Creek. Clark came up with the name Stormwater because there's a storm drain there. So that worked out, and we're trying to keep the rents approachable, which is a big problem. People get tired of me saying it, but I see a national problem with what I call rent gouging, which maybe started in San Francisco, went to Seattle, Denver, now it's everywhere. And it's part of the makeup of a service economy, which apparently we're 70% service, 30% making things. So we had a nice balance at one time, in my mind, of our economics. We had working mills. We had working steel mills.
Yeah.
We had all sorts of things. So we had a sort of a balance. So somewhere in the 90s, the ubiquity of money, I think we thought that we had so much money, we don't have to make things anymore. So we're going to offshore it. We're going to send it to China and other places, and we'll just buy it. So we started losing our manufacturing element. And then augment that now currently with AI and robotics. So the whole nature of making things is changing. So skilled craftsmen and machinists and so on are becoming less and less. They're still out there, but I could easily see like a construction line at say like a car manufacturer. There won't be anybody on the line. It'll be robotics and AI completely building these things. So we have to transform ourselves. And what does that mean? I don't know what it means. I don't know. We're in a sort of a transition here from making things into what, you know? So that's interesting. So we got in Stormwater, and Clark had relocated. He lost his building up there where he relocated, built down there. And we have one-eared cow there. So what we have is a little nucleus again, a triad, if you will, of arts. So we may have the beginning of a new, and we don't have a name for it yet. We're trying to figure out this again, like Meet Me at the Tower, if that was, you know, so Meet Me at the Triad, or I'll Meet You at the Triad, or whatever. And we also have a green element there. We have a certified habitat, the grounds are, and we have Karen Murphy, who's now putting in native plants. So we're going to have all of that there along with the artistry. So I already see maybe the developers, and they're pretty keen on that. They already see that the arts element was there, that triad. So the capital improvements along Huge are already starting.
Mm-hmm.
So there's heavy construction. The Klein site, you know, Klein left. So the Klein site is there. And we got the bus yard, and the jail's already gone. So I think we have an opportunity there because that's going to be the entry statement to the city. When you come in there, some people say the first impression is the only impression. So it would be good if we could start working with architects and designers to have some sort of some sort of architecture. I don't know what it would look like. Something really wonderful there that when you come in, you say, wow, and you want to turn your car and just go there. And since the river's right there, we got good access with Laurel Street and the parking. It's, you know, and leave as much of those collar lands, the trees as a buffer there so that we have this green element. Why? My horizon year has always been 50 years for planning. And it's like, and I learned that from Frederick Law Olmsted. Because when you go to Central Park and you see these big trees and boulders, they were put there. That tree was planted 100, 150 years ago. It was all planted. There was nothing there. Right. So you plant the tree, future citizens get the fruit. So it's nothing to me, and the way time goes, it's nothing to me, a 50-year or 100-year horizon. Imagine Columbia 100 years from now. And I envision, I always envisioned since my early times on the Saluda, that let all the cities develop their rivers, leave ours alone. And guess what? Maybe people will come. There's an undeveloped riverfront in Columbia, South Carolina. Let's go there and walk there and see otters.
We have very, very few spots to develop on our river, which I think is a good thing. So that's why focusing on the ecotourism that we could have there and expanding those trails and the partnership with Dominion and Irmo Chapin and others to really open up for people to explore and utilize the river for recreational and for a whole lot of reasons, but to take advantage of the beautiful. There's not many places that have class two rapids, Spanish moss, otters, mink. I still haven't seen one, but I take your word on it. But you know, the herons and the lilies and, you know, the trout fishing and the stripers that run and all of that. I mean, it's just, to me, it's such a beautiful place. I mean, having the Saluda and the Broad and the Congaree is pretty special.
It is. Regional planning is really what it was. So we need a partnership with our sister city, so to speak, KC, West Columbia, for them to protect their collar lands and us to protect our collar lands. And that was part of the water resources, the Scenic River, to try and protect the collar lands so that, say, a landowner gets there and for some reason clear cuts all the way to the river. And so you got nothing but a hillside with a house sitting on the top. Well, whether they know it or not, they've destroyed what made their house, why they had their house there, you know? So things like that, and as density and pressures gain, I think the value of that asset becomes more and more. And we had some assets and we could learn from that. We had an elevated railway here at one point. And the New York's High Line, somebody came up with the idea. They had an elevated railway. And somebody said, well, we don't want to tear it down. What can we do? And somebody came up with the High Line. My thoughts back then was, first of all, we had a piece of Iron Age architecture that no other city had. We had this elevated railway. What to do with it? And the only thing one thing I thought about was a light gauge electric rail loop that would actually go around and go to West Columbia free all the time. It was silent, quiet, 24/7, would just roll. So between these two banks of the river, and you'd leave the river natural.
Yeah.
So you go over there to State Street, and you mentioned a culinary artist. That is growing. Chris Denimi, you know, he could be on one of these urban canvases, you know, because, you know, the broad brush of artistic talent that's in this city and probably in the state is just unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. So, you know, we could make it, we could sit down and make a list of our assets so we don't make mistakes like that again. And one of the assets we have is the architectural element, you know, try and get challenge developers to make a mark for themselves and also for the city in excellence in their designs, in their buildings.
We need a little variation, you know. I mean, everything doesn't need to look institutionalized. I remember when I was a kid and we would drive through Columbia to go to the beach, I swore I'd never live here because the first impression I got was coming up Gervais Street. And I was like, there's nothing but power lines and industrials in this town. There's no buildings. There's no character. There's nothing. And, you know, and then it was steel companies and motor supply offices and Columbia Industrial and others. And now you look at it, now is the time to start mixing some things in and getting some growth, some vertical growth, but some really cool architecture that ties in. And I know some people believe, well, we got to leave everything exactly the way it is. Well, you can blend it. Europe's been doing it for years. There's a reason why in communities in Europe, you got a building that was built in the 13, 14 or 1700s next to a beautiful glass building, and it works. It's because they the vision and incorporation and the collaboration as they put the thought in it, it complements it, doesn't take it away. And it'd be interesting to see what we could get done.
Yeah, when you consider architects, artists, which they are, and we need to engage them. That's an asset that doesn't exist right now, unlike the elevated railway and some of the others that went away.
But I laugh because you said, what is it going to look like in 100 years? And
right.
I'm sitting to... So when I first got elected, somebody gave me a book, The Modernization of Columbia in 1905, you know, and they talked about rail realignment. They talked about what's now Finley Park that was our own central
railway.
Park. Yeah, talked about all of these things and how we needed to develop our downtown and get away from the industrial. And it took us 120 years to get there, but we're getting there.
I have watercolors of that, not to tell my age again. Feeling pretty old here, so having bought cotton duck from Vernon Mills. But I've got watercolors of the train station, watercolors of the switchman's house, which nobody saw. It burned down. I've got watercolors of the elevated railway.
So why not make some prints of those and let's get them out and share them with people?
Could.
How about
nobody
how
knows about them?
How about do some of how cool would that be for that to be one of the urban canvases? These historical places that a lot of people didn't know about back then that were there.
Well, that's a good point. What if we put pictures of Columbia, historical pictures, around too with art?
Yeah.
And started to show people the history, the shared history that we would have. Once you look at that picture of that historical building and see it, then you become part of it. You're part of the citizenry now. That's a good idea. In other words, we're not going to restrict urban canvas to the artist, so to speak, but also photographs of our history, which would unite us. And we could have nature photographs too.
Absolutely.
Go down and get a picture of that mink and put him up
somewhere.
See it. So that would be good because it would remind people of the asset of the river and what it means. And again, horizon year of 50 years, we got to be very careful about how we develop that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Stephen, thanks for being here today.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
This was
exciting.
It was fun. I'm so excited about the program. Folks, stay tuned and look out as these urban canvases start to pop up. And as you know, we're working on our trout art program so that we can raise some more money and do some more creative projects here in the community. But if you got a great idea for an art project or something that we can enhance the quality of life here, please share it with us. We'd love to hear it because there are no bad ideas. They're all good. And we're excited about what's coming down the pipe. I know talking with Stephen, you know, the urban canvas is only the beginning of what we could have with the traveling art scene here in Columbia. And keep your eyes peeled, look out, take a selfie with it, and share it with us. Thanks for tuning in.